Okay, ready? Everybody settle and action.
Warning, Critique Revolve contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended,
you're one ugly motherfucker. Go ahead. Make my day.
Well, that's great. That's just fucking great, man.
It rubs the lotion on its skin. It doesn't even have any
control. I'm mostly coming out. Most of all.
There are
certain
rules.
Short round.
Dead.
Did you really believe you could do what you did to me? And that would be the end of it?
You brought us here for a reason.
Vengeance is mine.
All right, hello, welcome everyone to Critique Revolve, Rayman Digital's film, television, and media podcast. Today, we have a discussion and review planned for the upcoming Blumhouse horror film titled Black Phone 2. Black Phone 2 is, in fact, a 2025 American supernatural horror film that is a sequel to the 2021 film, The Black Phone. Scott Derrickson directs it from a script he co-wrote with C. Robert Cargill. And Jason Blum produced it. The film stars Ethan Hawke, Mason Thames, Madeline McGraw, and Jeremy Davies reprising their roles. The premise, in 1982, 4 years after the events of the first film, Finney Blake is trying to deal with the trauma from his kidnapping by and killing of the Grabber. Meanwhile, his psychic sister Gwen starts having terrifying visions of mutilated children and nightmares with a phone ringing. Okay, Dave, just by that opening premise there, visions of mutilated children. This is a much darker film than the first one. If that doesn't set the tone for this discussion, then I don't know what will, because this is an interesting take on a sequel. After this movie, Dave, I'm leaning towards the idea that this might be the next horror IP, the next horror franchise a la Saw or Ty West's X trilogy. This might be the new contender, right?
Oh yeah. I think it could definitely follow where Ty West was with the X trilogy. And honestly, after this film, if it does become a franchise, this becomes one of my favorite franchises in the horror genre.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. And this movie, I guess you can say this franchise now, shares similarities with Ty West's trilogy, meaning there's definitely, for those that are able to pick out these nuances, you can tell these are two directors that love film, because they utilize the genre and the form to its fullest potential in order to tell their story. And it's not just like the usual pastiche. There is an actual understanding of what they're using in order to tell their stories. And I'll get into more of that as we progress through our discussion today. Now, David, this will be spoiler free. We are going to walk the line very carefully. There will be, if we feel like it's needed, a spoiler section towards the end. And Dave, we will let listeners know when to tune out if they don't want things to be spoiled. All right. So, for those that enjoyed the first film, director Scott Derrickson builds upon the foundations established in The Black Phone to explore what I would say the emotional dimensions of fear and possibly familial grief, while at the same time, in relation to genre now, taking the story in a somewhat different stylistic direction. Now, while the sequel may not be entirely original conceptually, it remains a powerful and expansive continuation that poses new questions. What?
Yes.
While bringing narrative closure to its characters and themes, and depending on how you interpret some of the story components, it does feel like this could be a very satisfying ending for our protagonist. But, as is the case with some of the most iconic horror films, there are allusions to there being more. More to the world our story takes place in, more to the villain.
Yes.
And if you're familiar with Derrickson's work, he draws, or I should say he's drawn, to stories where one can create an elaborate cosmology, meaning his diegetic canvas is immense, which yes. allows for possibility. That's one of the things that I absolutely loved about the first movie. It wasn't just this simple world that he was created. There were illusions. There was a feeling that there was much bigger things happening behind the veil, just outside of the camera frame.
Well, that's the beauties of this series and the beauties of like Scott Derrickson's direction with this franchise, because make no mistake, the first Black Phone film, it was a very personal story, but just like what you said, the way that Derrickson was able to add things to kind of generate character understanding by kind of exploring the world that is around them. Like here, I was really curious to see, okay, is he going to be able to continue a personal story, but have this cosmology, like what you said, that surrounds it, that basically there's more details that for people who are looking at it and get passionate about the films will start actually having fun with it.
Yeah. And these are definitely things, as I was saying, Dave, that Derrickson is in fact drawn to. Pretty much every movie he's ever worked on, there's always allusions to something bigger. The mm-hmm. film itself is small scale, you know, smaller budget on the smaller end of the budget spectrum, except for, of course, Doctor Strange.
Yes.
But even Doctor Strange, one of my favorite MCU films to date, there is this elaborate cosmology. And yes, understandably, that's something that was actually implemented in the comic books, right? We understand that, as well as the evolving MCU story itself. But my point is Derrickson is drawn to those types of stories.
Yes.
Stories where there is a much bigger world that others may or may not be able to see or are in fact privy to. And this is exactly what he did with the second movie as well. And in doing so, audiences are strategically left with bigger questions, a tactic which was utilized, in my opinion, with great success in the first film as well as the second one.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Dave, what are your initial thoughts?
My initial thoughts, this was actually one of my most anticipated films this year, because I loved Black Phone 1. It came out of nowhere. No one really thought Black Phone was going to be the big success that it was. When word of mouth started spreading, I love the fact that everyone kept saying the same thing. It's such a personal story, but there's so many things going on. It makes you want to watch the film multiple times. It creates that film water cooler moment. Give Derrickson credit. I was like really worried that with Black Phone 2, he wouldn't be able to capitalize on it or add to that type of mythos. But sure enough, he actually was able to, because by the end of the film, there's more here than just a simple answer that we would think from Black Phone 1.
Yeah. And that's something that I was not, or another thing I wasn't expecting in terms of fleshing out, Dave, is actually the psychology of the Grabber himself.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll get into that during our spoiler section, because I want to be very careful when it comes to anything specifically connected to him, because if we say too much, we do run the risk of really messing up the story or the movie for other people.
The one thing I want to actually bring up about the Grabber, particularly after this one, Ethan Hawke is just awesome as the Grabber. Like, in the first film, he made a very stereotypical serial killer into something more dynamic. And in the second film, he does that again.
Yeah, he's working for his money.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you do when you hire someone like Ethan Hawke to play a role like this. Let him perform. Let him do his thing. And he does a fantastic job throughout the movie. But we'll get into the acting aspects a little bit more in a moment, David, because I do have a few things I want to get into when it comes to the acting itself. Now, Dave, I know you've been thinking about this film for several days now.
Yes.
Just as I have. At surface level, this film might be or might seem like it doesn't offer much in the way of critical analysis, but that would not be true. As a movie fan, there's a lot to like. And as an objective and observant film critic and or film theorist, there's even more to appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take a closer look at what Derrickson and his team does and how they shape this world we find ourselves in. And these are the things we've been talking about. We've been alluding to laying down the stepping stones to get to. Now, as I mentioned, this film does alter its form to align with the slasher conventions of the 1980s. In fact, the most striking evolution between the two films actually lies in the genre shift itself.
Yes.
From the psychological thriller sensibilities of the 1970s to the more visceral slasher aesthetics of the 1980s. And thankfully, this shift does not signal, which often happens, does not signal a departure from Derrickson's authorial vision. Instead, the director repurposes the stylistic strategies of the first film to suit a different cinematic era, as this movie takes place in the 80s and the last one took place in the 70s. It's a type of pastiche that exemplifies the film's commitment to inhabiting rather than parodying, which is something we talk about a lot in our film discussions. There is a difference in capturing something familiar, something we've seen, an homage, pastiche, postmodernism, whatever it may be. What we get oftentimes when directors try to delve into those waters is we get kind of a rudimentary parody of something we've seen at one point in our lives. This is incredibly different. The formal aesthetic language of the era, it evokes what it's supposed to do properly. And this is not the work of a hack who seems to be playing around with things he's seen before, but doesn't quite understand what they represent and how they were or are supposed to be used.
Yeah.
For example, in The Black Phone, Gwen's psychic dream sequences are deliberately styled to evoke the look and texture of the 1970s cinema. Yes. It's one of the film's more talked about sequences. What makes this compelling, this aesthetic choice, it aligns with the film's late 1970s suburban Colorado setting and actually anchors the supernatural elements in a period specific visual language that many of us are familiar with. That's one of the strengths of that movie. Now, Black Phone 2 extends this approach, but adapts it to fit its 1980s setting. The dream and flashback sequences lean into a more distinctly 80s era visual language, which, interesting enough, David, this is something that a lot of people are probably going to dig. It incorporates a VHS texture.
Yes.
Yeah. And possibly even a Super 8 type of footage look that emulates the look of early home video of the burgeoning slasher era.
Yeah. This is something kind of like, I've always thought Stranger Things tried to do this with their connection to, look at the member berries of nostalgia, right?
Yeah.
This is a proper way of doing it. I really dug what they did here with her dream sequences, because it gave me vibes of like the early Freddy Krueger films with Nightmare on Elm Street. And it fits too when you actually think about it, because like the whole idea of Gwen, of Vin's sister, is the fact that her powers are the fact that she's affected by her dreams. What horror icon is so infamous in the 80s that had to deal with dreams? And I kept thinking to myself, as like, oh, I wonder if Derrickson really is using that pastiche. And some of the sequences that he uses in during the dream sequences, particularly in Black Phone 2, are so reminiscent of Nightmare on Elm Street right off the bat, especially when Gwen has to deal with the Grabber, because the Grabber is the ghost that basically can inhabit everywhere.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing, David. So you touch on those other films as well. What makes this even more nuanced is that the 1970s horror aesthetic, talking about, of course, the first Black Phone film, is often characterized by slow burn pacing.
Yes.
Psychological unease, moral ambiguity, and a grim realist texture. Mm-hmm. Now, this is broadly what the original Black Phone did, where Black Phone 2 veers drastically from the first is in its move into the more dominant trend of the 1980s, which is not just in its style or its use of style. It also is relying on the visceral, body-centered, and bloody horror itself, yes, the actual slasher film. In fact, if I had to categorize this as a specific subgenre of horror, this would be a slasher film, whereas the first one was a psychological horror thriller.
Yeah.
Which, again, was more prominent in the 1970s, more meditative, introspective. So Black Phone 2 didn't just alter its visual language to accommodate the decade that the new film took place in, but it effectively changed subgenres.
Yes.
And it's not a complete departure necessarily from the psychological, but there is an obvious and concerted effort to lean more heavily into those 1980s horror sensibilities.
The way I would make an example of this to any viewer out there that's listening to us is like, when you look at Black Phone 1, think about how horror films in the 1970s were like, specifically like The Exorcist. The Exorcist was a psychological horror that messed with your mind. It made you feel uncomfortable. It wanted you to be glued to your seat and you couldn't leave. And that's that otherworldly kind of like tension that makes you feel like almost sick is what Black Phone 1 was tailored for. Black Phone 2 was more kind of like, and it was like funny because as I was sitting next to you in the theater, I kept thinking to myself, why do I have the vibes of like, I am watching old school Friday the 13th, old school Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween, where I'm expecting the slasher to come out of nowhere and just spray the camera with blood, and not in a bad way.
No. This isn't a negative, but you are right, David. The Exorcist, you know, was horror through psychological and religious dread. Even because I'm saying this because I know horror fans are going to be like, excuse me, what about Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Though it has a very bloody reputation, it's actually restrained.
Yeah.
With the on-screen gore, and it relies heavily on atmosphere, texture, and suggestion, yes, which is very similar to Black Phone 2. Now, Halloween came out in the 1978, but that film is often considered the transitional text, the movie that changes or at least introduces the slasher framework, if you will. So now the 80s, you have things like what, David? Like Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, The Burning, The Sleepaway, yes, Camp, My Bloody Valentine. those films, the latter ones I just mentioned, that's more or less where Black Phone 2 lies.
And that's the thing that I thought was really brilliant on Derrickson's part. And on top of that, he was able to do this by still maintaining that personal story that was going on.
That's really why the movie is a win all the way around, right, David? Mm-hmm. Because it's not just what he's doing. What he's doing and how he's doing it is great in terms of visuals and capturing an era, everything we've just discussed. But let us not forget the very cornerstone of a movie, which should be the script itself, mm-hmm. which entails the fleshing out of character, the characterizations, the emotional weight. And this movie doesn't skimp on that at all. In fact, I would say this movie brought the emotions up a level.
Oh, absolutely. And I can automatically, there was a lot of people prior to the release of Black Phone 2, when certain news of Black Phone 2 came out and people were hearing that, oh, it's going to focus on the sister more than Vin. A lot of people
It's Finn. Yeah.
And everyone basically was like going, oh, they're going to forget Finny's story because, like, you know, if we're going to focus just on his sister, Finny's going to play like a probably disappear.
I'm not quite sure what you're saying. You're not saying they sidelined Finny. Yeah. In fact, Finny is definitely the protagonist, but he shared it more with Gwen. Because, in fact, you know what, David? I think the best way to say that is that the movie is still about them, but this particular film is more or less told from the perspective of Gwen.
Of Gwen, yes. And that's the thing is, like, the element of the family dynamic from the first film never got lost.
Thankfully, right? Because that was its strength. You know, seeing even the father played by the amazing, what's his name? Jeremy Davies. I love that guy. That guy just does not get enough credit. But even though he was, in air quotes, an abusive father in the first movie, he was incredibly sympathetic.
Yes.
You understood where he was coming from, the real pain of what he was going through. And that was continued over for the most part in this movie. But I will say, and this is not a spoiler, they allowed the resolve from the first movie to take effect in the second film, meaning yes. What was gained was not lost in this movie. So the very real character development, there was no backsliding. People remembered what they learned from the first movie and they added on top of that.
And that was the thing about the characters too, is like, they didn't just say, here's your character development, that's the end. No, they fleshed it out. So Derrickson was able to leave room for a lot of these characters to kind of continue on naturally, where it's like the father figure. Yeah. Just as you said, in the first one starts off as this abusive father, but as the story progresses, you begin to see why he's that way. And then
he's in true pain.
He's in trauma mode. Because, you know, in the first film, you find out his wife commits suicide and that literally destroys him. So I like the fact that Derrickson did not leave out any of the characters when it came to development, because he continued Finny and their father and Gwen at the same time.
Yeah. That's solid storytelling right there. If you can juggle the relevance of commentary on family and trauma while also delivering blood and violence, I mean, that's quite the achievement for a horror film.
Well, this is one of the reasons why I wonder why more people aren't banging on Derrickson's door, because he did a fantastic job with Black Phone. I believe he did a fantastic job with this second film. And he's also, you alluded to it earlier, he had a success in a big budgeted film like Doctor Strange.
Yeah, let's give him some more movies to do,
please. He needs more stuff to do.
Okay, so his biggest claim to fame so far is Sinister, Doctor Strange, Black Phone, The Gorge, which if people have not seen that movie.
Oh my God, yeah.
It is such a fun movie, dude. It's on Apple TV, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And then, of course, Black Phone 2. Now, he is credited with doing the 2008, The Day the Earth Stood Still, but we won't count that against him.
We can't.
We'll pretend that one doesn't exist. This is before he found his footing.
when he was just a young lad at that point.
Yeah, just coming up.
Just coming up.
Yeah, still wet behind the ears. As far as it pertains to the script itself, as far as the writing goes, it's effective. There were not any glaring issues with the writing. You've got the inciting incident, effective first act. There are some areas during the second act that we could have let breathe a bit more. This is probably one of the compromises, though, that was made when deciding to switch subgenres, because the pacing of the two subgenres are vastly different. Psychological horror versus slasher. I mean, yes, there's a very different feel in terms of energy. So that could be the reason for that. I think the relatively low body count helped in a lot of ways. Knowing what we are watching and the sheer visceral violence of it all made you worry about our characters a bit, because we were waiting for bodies to start dropping. So that helped with suspense. I was wondering when people were going to start dying. I'm like, we have a lot of cast here. Are people going to die? And that actually is an ingenious strategy. I think he was fucking with us on purpose.
Absolutely.
We need to stop there because no spoiler. If we say anything else, it'll be a spoiler.
Yeah, no spoilers. That's what I was going to bring up is like, we can't bring up the fact that.
Don't say anything.
Yeah.
Don't say anything. But I know what you're saying. But that was the interesting tactic, though. And remind me to, if I forget, David. Remind us to get back into this territory during our spoiler section, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Now, especially when you're waiting for something that you expect to happen and it doesn't, that's a tactic. That's not a mistake. That's a tactic. And that's all I'll say.
Well, think about it. He did that in the first film because he didn't show anything. He let the viewer's imagination get the best of them. Like, Ethan Hawke didn't... If you watch Black Phone 1... Ethan Hawke didn't see Ethan or the grabber kill these kids. It's always alluded to when he grabs them into the van.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I don't think anyone wants to see someone murder children.
Yeah. But that
is such a dark thing to begin with. But yes, David. And here, that's not a spoiler. We can say that. There are scenes. My God, I can't believe they did it. There are scenes in this movie that are truly disturbing. Now, it doesn't show. I will. You know what?
Spoiler section. Yeah. Spoiler section.
There are scenes in this movie that are incredibly uncomfortable.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I have mine listed. It just had me like squirming in my seat.
My son is disappointed. I'm very strict with my son with movies. I know I'm a horrible, boring dad, but. Listen, he has his whole life to become contaminated by violence and nonsense. So I let him watch the first one because I felt like the first one was very smart. In my opinion, it's a piece of art. It's very well made. It's a film. It's an actual film is how I would define it. So I let him watch it because there wasn't any gruesome scenes necessarily. So when I come home from the screening on this one, you know, my son asked me, how was it? Like, well, it was really good. You're not going to be watching it, though. I'm sorry.
Oh, come on, yeah, Mike.
He's a little disappointed.
But honestly, I don't blame you, because one of the things that basically I felt that Derrickson did, and the word you use at the beginning of this review is visceral. And...
That's what it is, right?
It is very visceral. It's able to capture something that I have been very adamant when people bring up horror films and talking about film history and horror films is like people always think that the 80s era of horror films was just gore, gore, gore.
Predominantly.
But everyone basically thinks, doesn't remember the fact that some of those elements, the quote unquote gore, like earlier, especially if you watch the very first Jason, Friday the 13th, it's visceral. There, it's just not gore. It's not just bloody. There's an element of you feel the kill.
It's almost tangible.
It's tangible, yes. And like, sure as shit, like Derrickson here, especially with the dream sequences with Gwen, you feel a lot of the quote unquote damage the grabber can do.
I like that you're saying that, like feel, because I agree. In fact, not to be a film theorist nerd here, but it almost makes me want to, when I was sitting down doing our show notes for tonight's discussion, it made me want to start writing an actual essay on the Black Phone film so far through a phenomenological lens, meaning talk about what it does, how it brings the viewer in, the experience of watching, and how it creates certain types of dread. Because this movie, in my opinion, is a perfect cultural artifact to actually delve into its phenomenological dimensions. There's just a lot there.
There's a lot
that's very well expertly put in there to make us pull us in, right?
It's
All right, I'll leave it there because I don't want to bore people, as I've heard so many times. I'm going to start my own podcast called The Boring Film Theorist. All right, so when it comes to acting, it was fine. It's a great cast. You can't really complain when you have people like Ethan Hawke, an A-list celebrity, an A-list star, an amazing actor coming in and playing what could very well be the next horror icon, the grabber. That's pretty amazing. And then we have Madeline McGraw, who is only, I believe, 16 years old, but she has an extensive body of work and she does such a great job as, you know, playing these types of roles. Jeremy Davies is fantastic. Miguel Mora as Ernesto returns. He played the brother of one of the characters killed in the last movie. And he actually introduced the screening for the Arizona viewers. He was actually at the screening, which was fun as well.
Well, don't forget, you have Mason Thames too. Mason Thames back as Finney.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me seeing the transition of Finney, because like that was the one thing I actually was interested in, because in the first film, he's young. He's this young kid that basically you are supposed to feel terrified for. The reintroduction of Finney, without getting into any spoilers, I thought was jarring, but it also felt very natural, because like when you go from 11 years old or say 11 years old to 15,
there's a big difference.
You see a big difference.
Yeah.
It's like night and day. Yeah. When it happens,
it's like me from the age of 40 to 46. Like, oh my God, what happened?
What happened to you?
So dumb. All right. So, final thoughts, David. Rather than adopting an ironic or self-reflexive stance, Derrickson employs the aesthetic pastiche earnestly and knowingly. Key word, knowingly. Using the formal qualities of each era to enrich the atmosphere and its genre identity. And in doing so, the sequel preserves, this is what you were saying, the emotional and supernatural core of the original, while also immersing it within a new historical and cinematic mode, fleshing out, if you will, introducing us to the larger world, letting us know that the illusions from the first movie were in fact hinting at something much bigger. The biggest question.
Now be careful. Be careful.
Spoilers. The biggest question is this. Will fans of the first film enjoy the second? Sometimes franchises or IPs that switch genre or veer too far from its roots struggle to satisfy its original fans. For example, as you just said, Megan. Megan went from one style of movie to a completely different movie for Megan 2.0. Now, for us, it worked fine. We understood what was happening. But for the mainstream audience, critics, they were like, what is this? Is not even remotely the same type of movie. So sometimes it can go over well, and sometimes it does not. I think the film is worth watching. Honestly, though I appreciate, and Derrickson did an exceptional job with this movie, it does lose something of itself with the change of genre, but it also gains something. Filmic prestige, if you will. Its ability to tell stories in different decades while also utilizing the dominant film trends of those decades to do it. I would say it expresses Derrickson's love and knowledge of the horror cinema, much like Ty West has done with his X trilogy. So it may have lost something, just to summarize, but it also gained much more. Black Phone 1, David, I believe originally I had given it an 89%.
Yes, I believe so.
Black Phone 2 is an 80% film. Solid movie, a great sequel, incredibly smart, but it does lose some of its more intellectual depth with its transition from psychological into the slasher. What about you, David?
When the film ended, I remember looking at you and saying, you know, I'm not too sure about this, because there was just something that felt off. But the more I thought about it, I did really like this film. And it tapped into something that basically, for me, is kind of like the nostalgia barrier when it comes to horror films.
Yeah.
Is the slasher film. I love slasher films.
Oh, yeah.
And the first Black Phone, I would have given a 90 because I love that film. I felt like, just like you said, it kind of lost something from the first one. And I thought about it, and you mentioned it just now, was like, you go from a psychological film to a more visceral slasher film. And I'm not saying slasher films are unintelligent, but slasher films are more visceral. They're not supposed to be intelligent. You're supposed to be scared of the next kill. Who's going to die next? And
it's a different ball game.
Yeah.
It's a different sport.
It's a different sport because like, can the heroes get away from the villain? That's the main crux of slasher films. With Black Phone 2, I still would put it Black Phone 1 over it, as I said, because I gave Black Phone 1 a 90, but I'm going to give Black Phone 2 a 88. Because I really think Derrickson has these skills that he's just showing film-wise, where he's able to actually craft a very wide-ranging mythos when it comes to just these two films. He's able to actually give it more substance, more nuance, more style.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to add to that, but really, David, you said it. I hope my grade or my percent doesn't, my score, there you go, score, doesn't deter people. It's still a solid movie. And as far as contemporary horror goes, David, are you ready for this? For me, that's right. The Black Phone films are on my list of favorites.
Yeah, same here.
Ethan Hawke's The Grabber, or Wild Bill, as they call him in the sequel, right? Wild
remember, Bill. Spoilers.
They don't know why. He is a horror icon in the making.
Yes.
And just like Mia Goth for Ty West's X trilogy and Tobin Bell's Jigsaw, there's something special about these films.
Well, the thing is, this is the only contemporary character, Mike, and this is coming from someone who their bread and butter is the horror films. Mm-hmm. I love horror films. This is the only character contemporary wise that I have ran into where I legitimately want to go out and buy his mask.
Yeah. I want to live like him and kill children. That's what
yes, I do.
But David, that's maybe I should explain a little bit more. That's what I meant by filmic prestige. When I said that the first movie had something more and this one lost something, but in its process of its change, it also gained something else. Mm-hmm. And I said filmic prestige. And what I meant by that is that Derrickson has complete control over his visual vernacular. He has proven with this movie that he doesn't just love movies. He actually understands them.
Yes.
And that, David, is a rare thing. I know that sounds silly, but this is what I do. I study film. And in today's movie making environment, there are directors who don't even understand basic concepts of genre.
Yes.
And what genre conventions are and what should and should not be in specific genres. You know, it's iconography, it's semiotics. There are things that belong. And Derrickson, just like Ty West, has shown a greater understanding of filmmaking. And their own love of film have seeped into their work. And for someone like ourselves, who are film aficionados, people who love movies, I feel a kinship there. I can appreciate that they love movies so much that you can feel it in the styles that they bring to their movies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's why I say is like, I want to see more what Derrickson can do, not just with Black Phone. I would be happy if he continued on with Black Phone.
I think he's a little clipped by the man who wrote it, Joe Hill.
Joe Hill.
I was reading in an interview that Joe Hill puts a lot of don'ts, and a part of me wants that to stop. I'm like, Derrickson has proven he can make other movies just fine. Let's see what he can do without those hindrances. I mean, I get artistic integrity and wanting to save something that you like of yours, but I would like Erickson. I would love to see him do something that's completely his.
That's the problem, though, with Joe Hill, just in general as a writer. He's done so many really, really popular horror stories.
I know.
That he's allowed to actually have those, I guess you could say those reins.
Yeah, he's one of those people.
He's one of those people.
He's earned it, right?
But to your point, I would like to see Derrickson just break out into something different. And see what else you can do.
Yeah.
Because he has the skills.
Yeah, I'd love it. I would love to see what he can do. Okay, so David, spoilers.
Okay.
Let's give everyone a moment to vacate the premises.
Dude.
First thing is body count. There is no body count.
Zero. And dude, I'm gonna tell you right now.
Go ahead.
Because I'm so excited about this. I love it.
I do too.
I love the fact that there's no body count. But yes, people got hurt. People got hurt and mutilated, but no one died. And I was like going, a slasher film.
Where no one dies.
Where no one died. I wanted... If I could have Derrickson in front of me, I would have shook his hand and say, God bless you. Because you did something that I have always told horror fans to their faces that you do not need a body count.
He broke the cliche.
He broke the cliche. Yeah, he broke the cliche. And I was like going, there's no body count. But you still get the sense of dread.
But it's very much a slasher film. But that's where the psychological components come into play. Where you normally might have a dead person, you can quickly use the metaphysics of his world to cast people to the past where they witness people dying. but not actually in the contemporary frame or time frame that the movie takes place in. And David, there's intelligence there in terms of strategy. When you have the entire cast still, well, first, there's more people in this movie.
Yes.
Than the last one. So the first thing I thought, which I'm sure everyone else did, which is the reason why he did it, was lots of people are going to die. So you're waiting for to die. You're waiting for all of those classic moments when someone's supposed to die. Guess what? They don't die.
Exactly. It's interesting to me because I could see horror fans complaining there's not much of a body count. And I would tell them, you guys do realize the grabber, his power is driven by fear.
Yeah. And also
he doesn't want them dead.
And also I think that the three children you actually see get mutilated, I think that should do the trick.
Yeah. And that's good enough.
Now, I wouldn't count that as a body count because those were things that took place prior to the events of the movie.
Yeah.
And it didn't actually happen necessarily on screen until we saw it through Gwen's visions.
Yes.
So that's how they kind of cheat the system. So there isn't a body count, but there is. So that stuff was interesting what they did there. Also, there are definitely allusions to there being another movie.
Yes.
But this movie ends so positively and so absolute for the family itself. There's a lot of resolve there. They could go back later, but I would feel like they would do damage to what they did in this movie with the family and how they closed out and answered a lot of questions you had about the family. If they were to go back and use them, I think it would undo a lot of what they did in the second movie. But, and this is me saying this, I hate prequels, but because this movie relies on not necessarily time continuity, there's a lot of time jumping because of visions. We find out now that these aren't dreams.
Yes.
In the first movie, you think they're dreams that Gwen's having. And in the second movie, they let you believe that these are dreams. What you find out is they're actually moments when she enters into a different dimension. And it's a type of ghost dimension, I guess you can call it, where she can observe the spirits. It's the same realm that Finny can hear.
Yes.
Finny can hear it because they reach out to him, but he cannot see that world. Gwen's abilities are different. She enters the actual ghost reality and is able to commune and interact in a very real world where pain, violence, death can in fact occur. So it's a whole other realm now. So that's another aspect that I love about this movie. And David, tell me if you got this, but it also seems like when I say prequel, we don't know the extent of his murders. What they established, which is now canon, is that the only reason why he returned is because there were spirits that were unable to rest. There were people that he killed, his former victims. As long as those spirits are unable to rest, he can draw power from their fear and he can manifest himself and escape the depths of hell.
The depths of hell.
So, David, if we were to take this logic and follow it through a bit, that means anyone he's ever killed in any location that we don't even know about, that the writers can just dream up, guess what could happen? He can return.
He can return. And that's the, dude, one of my favorite moments in the movie is when the grabber is talking to Gwen after a certain twist and he explains to her what hell is. And that moment gave me chills because it helped establish the grabber as more than just now a serial killer. He enters the iconography now for me as a Jason or a Freddy Krueger or a Michael Myers, where there's a supernatural element to all those characters now, where if you look at Black Phone 1, he was just a simple serial killer. In Black Phone 2, you add that supernatural element where he tells Gwen, I went to hell and they took all the good parts out of me, leaving all my sin.
Okay, so let's pause there and then we got to close out, Dave. I want to add to that. That was the biggest clue that we may have a prequel down the road, because the one thing this movie didn't do and it doesn't destroy the movie, but it makes you wonder why. The only thing they did not flesh out, the only person, is the grabber himself.
Yes.
They, again, hinted subtly at certain little things, like the fact that he actually was bothered that he killed his brother. In fact, that's the motivation for his revenge in this movie, that he felt Finney forced him to kill his brother. So there's a psychology there that we haven't even really begun to unravel. And the fact that he says that he went to a place where they took the good
out of him
and only left the bad. Well, then there is so much more to this guy.
Yes.
So much more. We don't know why he carries balloons, why he wears the mask, why he is afraid to reveal his face. If you're looking at everything, or I should say the theme of much of these movies, it definitely centers around a notion of family, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the grabber is upset that he was forced to kill his brother. It seems like eventually we're going to learn about his own life and what type of family issues
he had.
And if we find out that him and his brother relied on each other, much like Finney and Gwen do, dude, that will make us look at this character completely different. And that's the type of stuff I like.
Well, it'll also make us look at Gwen and Finney differently, too, because like when you watch Black Phone 2, I'm kind of surprised the direction they took Finn, because you went from this really traumatized child to a dark character, honestly. Like, Finney in this one is broken. Like, I give a lot of props to...
There's lots of aura farming.
I give a lot of props to Matthew Thames for playing Finney in this one, because, like, there's, like, this... To me, there's this undercurrent of... more going on in Finney's head than just him telling his sister and his dad at one of the moments that he's tired of being afraid. He's been afraid for 4 freaking years at this point, but he also shows this like rage that when the grabber shows up and he assaults Gwen, Finney just loses his mind just as bad as the grabber. So it made me start thinking, can Derrickson play around if he does do another thing where maybe if they continue the story of the family, the father, Finney and Gwen, are they trying to say that Finney can turn into the grabber where you have him literally?
Well, they have the same abilities. That was already said in the first movie. Remember the ghost kids told Finney that he can also hear the phone,
but he refuses
to acknowledge it.
And look what Finney does in the second film. In the very beginning, what is he doing? He's ignoring it.
Yeah, I have a feeling that they're going to more closely connect the two families, because you had the mother play a big part in this movie.
Yes.
Major spoiler. I don't even want to spoil that.
No, because that took me off guard. Yeah.
So there's a deeper connection there, because you have the power aspect, you know, the powers are similar, or I should say their abilities are similar, and just the way they connected the families like they did in the second movie. Yeah. So, all right, you know what? Let's close out this show, because I think we can honestly talk about these things for the next hour.
Oh, easily.
So let's close it out before we bore people and spoil the entire movie. All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Dave.
Bye-bye.
You're very nice to meet you. I'd like to know about sex change operations.
I see.
Cut. No good for sound.
Well, fucking hell, Lloyd.
Man, game over, man. It's game over. What the fuck are we going to do now? What are we going to do?
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
I'll be back.